From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff. We've spent the first 18 episodes of this season examining the conviction of Chris Bynum. That's the first step in any of our investigations, to determine if the state actually got it right the first time. In this case, there's no doubt in my mind that they did not. Without question, Chris Bynum is innocent. So that moves us on to the next phase of our investigation. If not Chris, then who? Who committed this horrific series of murders that night? Last week, the forensic analysis revealed two strong leads. Joseph Tidwell's DNA was discovered in the oral swab from Liz Ayers' sexual assault kit, and DNA discovered in the vaginal swab from Sheila Barty's kit came back as a match to a murder scene in Lake Station, Indiana, 10 years after her murder. Leon Frevel was convicted of that murder, although all signs seem to indicate that the DNA profile that's connected to our case isn't his. Still, it's another lead. Two names. Two living and breathing human beings. The son of a retired Gary police officer, Joseph Tidwell, and convicted murderer, Leon Frevel. But that's just the beginning. This week, before we take our Thanksgiving break, we're going to circle back to a familiar name. One that's been connected to this case from the very beginning. Deondrick McIntosh, or as everyone knows him, Shaky. Shaky's connection to this case at its inception is a bit of a mystery. We're told that there was an anonymous tip that named three people, although no one has ever seen any documentation of that tip. In post-conviction proceedings, Detective Moxley claims that it was this tip that led investigators to Chris Bynum, but no mention of what the other two names were. Then we have Chris's first statement, where he names Shaky and Terrell Jackson as the actual murderers, a statement which he later revised to remove both men from the investigation. The question that I continue to ask myself is this. If Chris is innocent, and I believe he is, and he doesn't actually know anything about these murders, and the narrative he gave actually came from Detective Donald, then why did Donald insert Shaky and Terrell into the narrative? Was it all bullshit? Or was there actual, credible information indicating that they should be suspects? I'm hoping to answer that question today. Not necessarily whether or not Donald has reason to suspect Shaky, but rather, do we have reason to suspect him in these murders? Throughout the years of Chris's post-conviction proceedings, a lot of investigative work has been performed on his behalf. Part of that process included investigators looking for witnesses who might know something. And since the Gary PD never bothered to ask any questions, the defense investigators did. And what they found is pretty shocking. What you're going to hear today are affidavits that were sworn by four separate, unconnected witnesses. Four people who all told the investigators consistent stories with no connection to Chris Bynum or to each other. And every single one of them has a consistent theme. They all believe that Shaky McIntosh is responsible for the murders of Liz, Sheila, Amp, Suzanne, and Angela. Continuing on with the theme of what we've been doing this season, I'm going to read these affidavits to you in their entirety. I want you to hear every single word as they were written. And as you hear them, you're going to notice a common theme. Everyone is terrified of Shaky. Now, currently, Shaky is in prison, but he's going to get out eventually. So in order to not put these brave people in danger, I'm not going to share their names publicly. Just know that the names are known and efforts are being made to get more clarification, particularly in the case of this first statement. I can't tell you who swore out the affidavit, but I can tell you that this person is related to someone who has a direct connection to this case. I'll just say that it's extremely, I don't want to say suspicious, but definitely intriguing that this person didn't come forward earlier, given their connection. To further protect their identity, I'm going to be a little vague about where the person was living at the time of the murders. With that being said, here's the first affidavit dated June 30th, 2010. Quote, affiant number one, being first duly sworn upon their oath, alleges and says, on February 17th, 2000, I lived near the Ballfield crime scene in Gary, Indiana. On the date mentioned above, I came home about 12:30 a.m. and went into the house. I cannot smoke inside the house, so about 20 minutes later, I came outside to smoke a cigarette. I heard gunshots coming from the baseball field. Then someone was running from the baseball field, and I looked over there. I saw a man I knew as Shaky running from the field up Idaho Street. He was alone as far as I could see. He was wearing a black hoodie and blue jeans. There was snow on the ground. Shaky's real name is Deondrick McIntosh, and I knew him from around the neighborhood. I learned later that day that two dead bodies were found on the baseball field. I never told the Gary police what I saw because I was scared of Shaky because he had a reputation as a bad guy. I swear or affirm under penalty of perjury that the above foregoing representations are true and correct. End quote. So in this first affidavit, we have a direct witness who says in no uncertain terms that they heard the gunshots and witnessed Shaky, a man who they know personally, fleeing the scene on foot. The sad part about this affidavit is the fact that while the affiant was afraid to go to the police themselves, had the investigating officers canvassed and followed up with all the residents who lived near the ball field, this information could have been obtained before Chris Bynum was ever even arrested. Hey everybody, Bob here. I'm interrupting this ad break to tell you how you can never have to hear another ad and take a huge step towards helping us continue our work all at the same time. As most of you know, I provide all investigative and advocacy services to the people and attorneys that we cover on the show completely free. Over the years, we provided hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of professional investigations to the wrongfully convicted, completely free of charge. And the reason that we're able to do that is in large part thanks to the support of listeners like you. Our Patreon community funds the overwhelming majority of our work, and I want to take this opportunity to ask and encourage you to join the club. The base level membership is just $5 a month. Now, while that's only a cup of coffee's worth out of your account, it makes all the difference in the world to us and the people that we work with. And for your $5 a month, you get a whole list of extra content, exclusive just for patrons. Every week, Janet, Zach, and I do an hour-long live stream just for our patrons. You also get an unedited video version of the Friday follow-up every week, a weekly pregame podcast that drops into your podcast feed. Patrons often get to participate in interviews that we do on the show live days or weeks before the rest of the audience gets to hear them. And of course, the best part, all of our content is completely ad-free for our patrons at the $5 a month level. Patreon really is the only way that we're able to keep doing this work. And it would mean the absolute world to me, Zach, Janet, and Erica if you'd consider joining if you're able to do so. Joining the Patreon community is super easy. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. Or you can go right to the episode description of this or any episode and just click the link. Thank you from the bottom of our hearts for your support. And now I'll return you to your regularly scheduled ads. The The next affidavit was sworn out by a neighbor of Amp and Suzanne. Just like the first one, I'll be editing just a bit to conceal exactly where this person lived at the time of the murders. Here is the second affidavit. Quote, I, affiant number two, upon my personal knowledge, information, and belief, allege and say, on February 17, 2000, I lived near the crime scene on 10th Avenue in Gary, Indiana. I was 16 years old. I had a direct view of the crime scene from where I lived at the time. Between 12:30 to 1 a.m., I was on the telephone in the living room of my home when I heard gunshots. I looked out of the window and saw two people I knew as Rob G. and Shaky coming out of the front door of 4412 East 10th Avenue in Gary, Indiana. Rob G. and Shaky got into a big brown car, maybe a Chevy or Cadillac, and took off. I knew Rob G. and Shaky from the neighborhood. Shaky's real name is Deondrick McIntosh. I think Rob G.'s real name was Robert Carr. Later that morning, the police were everywhere, and that's when I found out three people were killed in 4412 East 10th Avenue, Gary, Indiana. I never spoke to the police because I feared for my safety and the safety of my parents. I swear and affirm under the penalties for perjury that the above and foregoing statements are true and correct. Dated June 10th, 2010. Here in this affidavit, we have a new character introduced to the narrative. I was able to confirm that this affiant did indeed live in clear view of the crime scene on 10th Avenue. I also have not found any indication of a connection between the witness who swore out the first affidavit and this person. So we have two completely independent witnesses, neither with any connection to Chris Bynum or to each other, both swearing that they saw Shaky fleeing the crime scenes. And in this one, we hear that a man named Robert Carr was also involved. There is no uncertainty in this statement. The affiant says that they very clearly saw both Shaky and Rob, and also that they personally know them both. We'll get more into Robert Carr later, but a quick search shows that he has an extensive criminal record, and he's now deceased. This isn't the last time that his name comes up in the post-conviction investigation. This next affidavit doesn't involve an eyewitness from a distance. This person had direct contact with Shaky and Robert Carr after the murders. Here's what they swore to. Quote, affiant number three, being first duly sworn upon her oath, alleges and says, on February 17th, 2000, I lived in Gary, Indiana. The date mentioned above in the early morning hours, maybe about 3 a.m., I heard hard knocking on my front door. I went to the door and peeped out and saw that it was Rob Carr and Shaky, who I now know is named Deondrick McIntosh. I let them both into the house. I saw blood on both of them. Rob and Shaky had blood spatter and smears on their pants. Rob was wearing a red and black leather jacket to his waist. Shaky was not wearing a jacket. He had blood on his shirt. He had the most blood on him. Shaky was acting normal. Rob was acting nervous. I heard Rob asking Shaky, why did he do that dumb shit? Shaky said he had to because the bitch recognized me from that other shit. Then Shaky said that none of this shit better not get out. Then they argued about something. I could not tell about what because I was in my bedroom. I heard Shaky ask Rob to tell your girl to give me a t-shirt. I gave Rob a regular white t-shirt for him. Shaky went into the bathroom for about 10 minutes. When he came out, he was wearing the white t-shirt. He took the other shirt with him. I heard the front door open and saw that Shaky was leaving. He turned around to Rob and me and said, none of this shit better get out or I'm coming back for you and that bitch. Rob asked me for a t-shirt. I gave him a t-shirt and a pair of gray jogging pants. He took a shower and changed into the clothes. Then he went outside and put his bloody clothes in the barbecue grill and set them on fire. He stood there and watched the clothes burn. He came back into the house and sat on the couch with me. He was smoking and holding his head in his hands. I asked him what happened. He said nothing, so I asked him again. Then he looked up, his eyes were watery, and he said Shaky just shot five people. I was shocked and did not know what to say. Then I asked him why he did not call the police. He said he could not call the police. He told me to go stay with family out of town if I could. He stayed at my house until about 11 a.m., then he left. Before leaving, he told me to be careful and that he would be back. I never saw Rob or Shaky after this. Day or so later, I read the newspaper about five people being killed in the Etna section of Gary, Indiana. I moved myself and my five children out of the house about 2 weeks later and did not tell anybody where we were going. I never spoke to the police because I was afraid of Shaky, because he had threatened me before February 17, 2000. I swear or affirm under the penalties for perjury that the above and foregoing representations are true and correct. End quote. Dated October 25th, 2010. I don't know how you argue with that statement. Again, this woman has no connection to the two other affiants or to Chris Bynum. She has nothing to gain and everything to lose by coming forward. The story is free from exaggeration or unnecessary details. In fact, the affiant doesn't claim that she even knew what Rob and Shaky were talking about at the time. She didn't piece things together until she saw the news reports later. And if we connect the timelines of the previous affidavit to this one, they're not only consistent, but they flow together chronologically. The first person lives near the crime scene on 10th Avenue and saw Shaky and Rob run out of the front door after the gunshots. They got into a car and drove away. Then the second person finds Rob and Shaky at her door after Rob says Shaky had shot five people. At this point, you have to be asking yourself, what are the odds that two completely independent witnesses both swear to be direct witnesses to Shaky and Rob committing these murders, and both are either wrong or lying? Add to that the third affidavit from the person who says, without question, they saw Shaky fleeing the ballpark scene on foot after the gunshots. How likely is it that all three of these people got it wrong, and all three of them got it wrong in a way that puts them in serious danger by naming Shaky, who clearly terrifies all of them? The odds are nearly non-existent. This last affidavit might sound a little disjointed, but it's another direct witness, and if you pay close attention, her story lines up perfectly with the second and third affidavits. Here we go. Quote, on February 16th, 2000, about 11 at night, I went to the gas station near my house. I saw Rob, Robert Carr, up there getting some gas, so I stopped and talked to him for a minute. Rob then said, why don't you ride with me while I make some runs? We rode around for a little over an hour, drinking and talking. Sometime after 12 a.m., he made a stop at this house in Etna around the corner from where I used to stay growing up. When we pulled up in front of the house, it was someone who walked in the house right before him. Rob was in the house a few minutes, then I heard gunshots coming from the house. I looked up and saw Rob coming out of the house walking fast. I looked inside the house because the door was open and I could see Shaky, Deondrick McIntosh, standing in the doorway of the house shooting. I could see a white person standing, then fall to the floor. When Rob got in the car, I asked him what happened. Shaky ran out of the house and jumped in the back seat of the car, yelling at Rob to drop him off. Rob said, man, what you do that dumb shit for? I turned around to look at Shaky, and he yelled at me, what the fuck are you looking at? I got scared as all outdoors. I could tell Rob was scared. Rob told Shaky, man, you don't have to yell at her like that. Rob said, let me drop her off at the crib. He drove off. Rob let me off on the corner a couple of blocks from my house. Rob came over to my house about 2 weeks later, and I asked him what was all that with Shaky. Rob said Shaky was wrong for killing those people. I asked Rob why did he do it. Rob said Shaky told him they knew too much. I told Rob that I was scared. I said, man, I just knew he was going to shoot me. Rob said that's why I didn't take you back to your house, because I didn't want him to know where you stayed. He told me not to say anything about what I saw. I never mentioned what I saw until after I learned that a lawyer was trying to find me to discuss what I knew about the murders. I contacted the lawyer and told him what I knew. I swear or affirm under the penalties for perjury that the above and foregoing representations are true and correct. End quote. Dated July 19th, 2011. Now we have four different affidavits from four different people with no connection to each other or to Chris Bynum. We don't know with any degree of certainty that all four affidavits are 100% true and accurate. Over 10 years had passed before these stories were finally recorded. We have to consider fading memories and, of course, the obvious fact that people do lie. Although in this case, it's hard to come up with a motivation for completely fabricating these stories. None of these people were obligated to speak to the defense investigators. None of them had anything to gain whatsoever by implicating Shaky or Rob Carr. And by doing so, they actually put themselves into serious peril. But again, memories do fade, especially after an entire decade. That said, let's try to piece together a reconstruction based on these affidavits if we were to assume that all four are true and accurate. It would have went something like this. Shaky stops by Amp's house earlier in the night with Liz, Sheila, and some unknown second person. That's based on Larry saying he heard two men. According to the last affidavit, that person was not Rob Carr, because Rob Carr was with that person at that time. Shaky leaves with the two women, and they go to the ball field. There, Shaky kills Sheila and Liz. At that point, he bails on his accomplice and takes off running. That's when the first affiant sees him leaving the scene. Somewhere along the line, he stops and uses a phone to page or call Rob. That is, unless it was just happenstance that they both showed up at Amp's house at the same time. But Shaky's on foot now, and he's going to need a ride after he takes care of business on 10th Avenue. So he could have told Rob to meet him at Amp's house. Shaky gets there on foot, and shortly after he arrives, Rob pulls up with the fourth affiant. Rob gets out of the car and follows Shaky inside. Our fourth affiant is in the car waiting, but the second affiant doesn't see them. Shaky shoots everyone inside, which gets the second affiant's attention. They then see Shaky and Rob leave the house together and get into the car. Rob drives down the road and lets the fourth affiant out of the car. He and Shaky then proceed to the third affiant's house. And that's where they show up with the blood all over them. And Shaky changes his clothes and he leaves. If all four affidavits are to be believed in their entirety, I think that's pretty close to how things would have had to have shaken out. But the larger point here is that regardless of whether or not all of these stories are fully accurate, they do all have a consistent theme. Shaky McIntosh was responsible for the murders of all five victims, and Rob Carr was directly involved. And on top of that, no one, not a police investigator, a prosecutor's office investigator, or defense investigator, has ever been able to find one single witness who can say that Chris Bynum had anything to do with any of this. I know this is a lot to take in, and unfortunately, it's going to be a week before we have a chance to discuss it on a follow-up because of the holiday break. But before I leave you, I want to take this one step further. All of these witnesses were discovered years after Chris's conviction. So I find myself asking, could the Gary PD have found them in the days following the murders? Even in the hours or minutes following the murders? And the answer is yes. Easily. A canvas of all the houses near the ball field crime scene would have led them to affiant number one. And like I said earlier, while none of these people were willing to volunteer information to the police due to the fear of retaliation from Shaky, I want to believe that they would have shared what they knew if the police went to them. In that circumstance, they would at least know that the Gary detectives were actually trying to solve the case. There would be a high likelihood that Shaky would be taken off the streets immediately, and most likely their identity would be protected. So witness number one would have given them their first lead. Shaky fled the scene. Then if we add in a canvas of Amp and Suzanne's neighbors, they would have found the second witness, who would have told them about Shaky and Rob fleeing that scene. From there, they would obviously pick up both men and hopefully actually do their fucking job and start investigating them. That would certainly have led them to question Rob's girl, who would have blown the case wide open. An honest and real investigation would have resulted in tangible evidence against Rob Carr and Shaky in a matter of hours. So how do we combine this information with what we learned last week? That's a good question, and honestly, I don't have the answer to it yet. What we know from last week is that Joseph Tidwell had sexual contact with Liz that night, at some point likely within an hour or two of her death. Given what we've learned today, that might mean that he's more of a lead than a suspect. Either way, he needs to be investigated further. And then we have the DNA from the doorknob at the home invasion scene in 2010. We don't know who that DNA belongs to, but we do know that it belongs to someone who had sexual contact with Sheila on the night she was killed. Could it be Shakey's DNA? Rob Carr's? We just don't know because as far as I can tell, it's never been compared to them. Or could that DNA have come from the biggest gap that we have in this investigation? Could it have come from another Chris? I've been telling you for months that there is another Chris connected to this case. When we return, you're going to hear directly from him, in his own words, in his actual voice. That's in 2 weeks on Truth and Justice. Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music is created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weber. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kaywood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X @truthjusticepod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney, and Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.